Hello and welcome to the Emotion at Work podcast, where we take a deep dive into the human condition. And today's recording is happening approximately 4 years since the COVID-19 pandemic began in the UK, where my guest and I are based today. Now, I've had the privilege of working alongside our guest for, I think it must be nearly 10 years, I think, since we first met. And I've worked with them across different settings and in the, where they currently are in terms of maintaining well-being, supporting resilience of their colleagues, where the pandemic hit in the UK hardest anyway within the NHS. And primary care, which is the part of the NHS that our guest works in today, is a hugely challenging setting from an emotion perspective. And as you know, fair listener, I do love emotion. You've got patients that are unwell and or emotionally charged already, so their ability to regulate their emotions could be inhibited. Those providing the care, that especially at primary care, that people need are often overstretched. And those that are there to help the patients or those providing the care are then contending with regulating their own emotions as well as the emotions of others that are around them. And if you're interested, fair listener, in emotions and emotional labor, we've covered a lot in episodes 2, 25, 26, 27, and a special edition of episode 37. So if you want more on those things, then go and have a listen to them. But today, we're taking more, I guess, of an applied and a contextually specific look at how leadership in this emotionally charged and challenging environment has moved from what was in person to then maybe needing to be hybrid or remote. And yeah, I'm just really excited to hear the stories and experiences and insight that our guests will bring. So let me welcome to the Emotion of Work podcast, Emma Wall. Hi, Emma.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's going to be, for the listener, we've just had about sort of 20 minutes catching up off air, which has been lovely because I haven't seen Emma in ages. So it's been really nice to catch up.
It's been quite a long time, isn't it?
It has been a while. And I'm really excited about the podcast today. So before we begin, though, we always start the podcast with our unexpected and yet innocuous question. So my question for you then, Emma, is, are you handy?
Handy DIY, probably just enough to put a picture up. Handy with dealing with situations, very. Handy with cooking, no, not at all. Absolutely poor at it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so, I don't enjoy cooking at all.
We might be similar yet different then. So for me, handy with DIY, no, I am terrible. So one of the stories that gets told in my house a lot is that when we moved a few years ago, and in the house we were in before the one we're in now, I tried to put up a corner shelf in the bath for the kids to put their bath time toys on. And it ended up becoming a slide for the toys because the shelf wasn't straight. So they would put the toys on the shelf and then it would slide down the shelf and then into the bath because that's how bad I am. Handy with situations, similar to you, yeah. I feel like I am. Handy with cooking, I love cooking. Absolutely love it. Yes, one of my kind of relaxing go-to, one of my relaxing go-to tasks if I'm stressed, open the fridge, see what we've got, rustle something up, see other people enjoy it. Yeah, that'll do.
Oh, you're very lucky. It is one of my least favourite pastimes. I'm more handy with dogs, and in the last sort of few years, about 4 years, I've been into campanology. So I've been handy with a rope and a Sally. So that's been fun too.
With a rope and a what? Sorry?
A Sally.
What's that?
Yeah. It's the fluffy bit on a bell ringing rope.
Oh.
So ringing bells in a church. I got roped along when I was walking my dogs once by my friend. Mm-hmm. And then since then, I've been grabbed by a band in a local church and I go and ring bells.
Oh, fantastic. And I loved the pun that you did at the start of that as well. When you said I was roped in, I was like, oh, look at that. It's amazing. what did you say it was called again?
A Sally. So the fluffy bit that you see, you know, with all of the spirals, its yes. colour, that's called a Sally.
Okay.
And you hold on to the tail end of the rope and you hold on to the sally when you start. And then that's the bit that disappears up towards the roof and then comes back down again, and you have to learn. It's like learning an instrument. It's quite complex to start with, and everybody thinks that you have to be sort of He-Man or She-Man or somebody that's really strong. Mm. And yes, for the bigger bells you might need to be, but for the smaller bells, there's kids as young as 10 that are learning it now. And it is a dying art. There's not many people about that do that anymore. And the gentleman that teaches us is getting near his limits, and he's the one that disappears up into the tower when something goes wrong. So goodness knows what's going to happen in the future when this art of all these chaps and chapesses that used to do it have gone, that know all of that about it. So it's quite a niche thing to learn, and you don't have to be religious or spiritual to go. It is literally like learning music by learning how to use the bells.
Wow. So you used a word to describe the skill or the practice of it. What was that?
Oh, campanology.
Campanology. Okay.
Campanology.
Wonderful. Well, there's my learning for today. So
there you go. Learn something new every day.
Campanology and Sally.
And the Sally, yeah.
Yeah. Two things for today. Oh, wonderful. Thank you. So at the risk of being, I guess, maybe a bit obvious, 4 years kind of post-pandemic working in primary care, like, how are you?
Well, at the risk of sounding boring, quite tired. I think the change pace is massive within the environment, and it's still crazy. So people still need the service, and the demand exceeds what we can provide from the physical, financial and emotional level. I know my tribe is still totally passionate about helping people, but they're still hampered by being unable to help everyone. So that's an emotional challenge for them. So it is a balancing act from every perspective. And I'm still adapting to constant changes. So like now we're just dealing with a measles outbreak in the West Midlands. And of course, the knee-jerk reaction is everything needs to go back to pandemic kind of working, where we're getting constant information and constant ideas about how we can tackle these things. But I have to say, though, as a job working within primary care, you know, if you're interested in dynamic roles and you like constant challenges and being in the thick of it and having to think on your feet and quite, it's a cliche say, think fast, this is really a good role to be in. And it's a completely different day to day. I never have the same day. So being a practice manager in general practice would be something that I'd recommend, is, you know, a job where you learn skills that you've never learned before, even when you've been in leadership before. It's a completely different environment. So yeah, it's very consuming if you let it, though. That's the only thing. You have to have you know, space and time to reflect on it and take a step back.
Yeah, I think because everything is so varied, whether it be the services that you need to provide, the people that might be coming into practice, the colleagues that you might work with. I think, you know, within an organization, you know, or, you know, where we met within Boots at the time, often your role is quite focused, even in a big organization like Boots. You have a specific discipline or a specific area that you're focusing on, whereas a practice manager, it's, you know, everything really.
Yeah, I mean, practice manager in general practice is entirely different to practice manager in Boots Opticians, for example, and working in regional management in Boots Opticians. Again, like you say, you're fairly focused on delivery of the balanced scorecard, which is, you know, how the strategy works within the business, and focusing people's behaviours and emotions around those in order to deliver a retail environment. Whereas general practice is not retail; it's very much, and still is, the people within it wanting to provide the, you know, the best care they can possibly provide. And I think with this type of job, and the, there's a new institute that's been going for a couple of years now, Institute of General Practice Management, who are trying to raise awareness about the variety that the job has compared to any other practice manager role within any healthcare environment, because, you know, you are singly focused on where you are particularly working. So, for example, with Boots, you've got, you know, the same way of operating in every practice, and in dental, you've got the same thing. You've got, if you're in a, an environment where you're part of a larger chain, you're working the same way, and everybody's interchangeable, and they can go and help and support. Whereas general practice is a single environment, so they are single entities, mostly small businesses, and we are, you know, now we've been working so hard in the last 5 years to create a primary care networks where we're all part of that. But that you know, the tide of change is quite hard at that level, because each business is owned by the partnerships, and they all have had 30 to 50 years of previous internal processes or previous ways of working. So changing that mindset of if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. Sounds crazy. Clichés are here today for anyone that wants them. I'll happily carry on with them. But it's true. And I think I've probably learned about 10 or 12 different managerial skills and leadership qualities. And I've made so many mistakes, which I know, you know, everybody thinks mistakes are bad, but actually you learn from them hugely. And I think the pandemic itself allowed the practice to make those mistakes and to change processes and to make things better for themselves as a result of it, as a place to work. And I think, you know, whilst we're trying to balance patient safety and staff safety with actually being able to deal with the demand, that takes a lot of juggling, probably more than any environment I've been in.
And that point you made about mistakes, I find fascinating, because I can't remember if it's one of the big kind of HR conferences. I was talking to one of the conference organizers a couple of years ago, and I said one of the things that frustrates me when I come to conferences and events is everybody's always talking about the successes that they've had, the achievements that they've made, and the wins that they've secured. But I never hear about what went wrong, or how somebody tried to do something and it just didn't work, and the lessons that they've learned from that, which I said I find fascinating, because bearing in mind learning and development is a big part of HR, yet we just focus on the wins rather than what, you know, how have those things or those kind of mistakes helped us learn or develop. And without wanting to necessarily to put you on the spot and then going ahead and doing it anyway, what would be a mistake that you've made that you'd be willing to share?
I think the biggest mistake I've made is compromisation of my personal values, and in a funny way, getting offended by it. So if you think about the particular situation that we're going to talk about today around remote leadership. So if you're working around people and all you do is work around people, and then suddenly you're having to work remotely and you're unable to pick up on the social cues of body language, which, as we know, is a massive part of communication. When you're trying to set expectations and engage people in a process that they've never done before, and it's a significant change for them, I found that that's been the hardest mistakes I've made, where I've not overly communicated, like over to the point of annoying the heck out of them, because I constantly have to say, are you happy with that? Have you got any other ideas you might want to bring to this? Have you thought of any other solutions? Are you okay? Is there anything more, you know, just to be in when you're in a remote leadership situation and trying to manage those situations where they are not telling you of their emotional issues or their challenges that they can't face because they don't want to have that relationship where they have to ask for help, or they want to admit that they can't do something, and they'd rather fail than admit it. Do you know what I mean? And that happens in general practice upwardly towards the partners who are running the business, but obviously they impart all of that work to the general practice manager who needs to do that. So the upward influencing and checking in and supporting and making sure that they understand the impact of things and decisions they make or not make affects everyone below me. Was an issue for me, and trying to get that engagement from everyone, from all levels and all connections, I think remotely that was the hardest thing and the biggest change in my leadership. Or constantly, it was constant. I had to change, and that was really difficult, because as a person, I'm so, as you know, when I've done presentations with you, I am larger than life. I'm happy to be there. I'm happy to be in person. I want to know about people. I have a passion about, you know, everyone in my team. I try and make an effort to always say, how's the partner? How's the dog? How's the cat? Know the names of these people. But when you're remote and you're having to deliver something quickly because of the pace of change, that's where I feel I make a mistake. And I guess that's on me, not necessarily on those people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that takes us into...
Long answer.
No, I like long answers. because I think it's really important to let someone do their thinking, and it comes back to the pace of things that you were talking about earlier on. I think sometimes I can find when I'm in meetings in with sort of client organizations, or I'm part of discussions, when somebody begins their thinking, sometimes we can be quite quick to think we know what that means, and then we rush that thinking to a conclusion. Either we physically rush it by going, yeah, okay, I understand, thanks, or we implicitly rush it to a conclusion by kind of nodding, you know, excessively and going giving those paralinguistic clues that you were talking about earlier on, that yeah, we get it, yes, be quiet, hurry up. and what that then does is it hampers that individual's thinking, that it doesn't help them think well. As listeners to the podcast will know, it's very, very rare for me to interrupt somebody when they're sharing their thinking, because their thinking is really important. It's important to me and it's important to them. So one of my values is giving everybody that chance to speak and for their thinking to be heard, because everybody has the right for that, I think.
Yes. And for me, you know, in the actual adapting of my leadership, when we're having these conference calls, so in the pandemic, I'll share that the partners asked me to work from home because they didn't want me to fall, as it were, with the COVID, and therefore not be around to support them and the team. And so literally it was going from one day to the next, literally today, right now you need to go. Risk assessment, need to go, right, from tomorrow you're working from home. And I'm like, right, okay, so this is what I need. And at the beginning, I didn't say everything that I needed as well in order to do that, because as I explained at the beginning of this lovely conversation, I need people. I'm you know, extroverted. I need to be around people to understand them, moderate how I communicate or how I explain something to someone. And I was flung into, right, I have to be a lot more pointed about this. Now, all of you are going to need to be on a conference call on a phone in the middle of a tea room for me to talk to today. How are we going to go forward? Because and the power of silence was brilliant, because if I'm just not saying anything, someone has to fill that gap. And in general practice, people do fill those gaps. They want to say what they want to say. And that was that power of silence was a massive thing for this poor phone in the middle of the desk of our tea room with everyone sat around it leaning forward for every word. I could imagine it now because I wasn't there to see it. And you know, just not saying anything. This is the issue. How do we solve it? You know, and shutting up. And I think that giving them the space, just as you were talking about now, was also conducive to us being able to change quickly.
So you mentioned that the team changed quickly. You mentioned that you had to change almost constantly.
Yes.
So what have you, what did you over that, because so maybe for our listeners that might be outside the UK, general practice is is sort of your first point of call if you're feeling unwell. So you might call it your local physician, you might call it your local doctor. So it's the first place that you would go if you feel like there's an ailment. So if you had an accident or there was an emergency, that would be a different kind of care route. So you would tend to go to a hospital, to what in the UK you'd call an A&E, which stands for accident and emergency. If you're in the US, you might call it an emergency room. But primary care is that, yes, that first kind of port of contact. And primary care in the UK, and tell me if I get this wrong, Emma, but historically or typically was always very physical. So it was very in person. You were in a building together with, like you said, like a tea room with patients arriving at the practice. And then COVID kind of, well, the pandemic, I suppose, just completely shifted that. So what did you have to, sorry, that was a bit of additional context for the listener. I suppose come back to my question then is, where or what did you have to add to your skill set when you had to lead in that quite different way, maybe to how you'd had to have led in the past?
That's a very good question. So as far as general practice is concerned, they are part of the primary care offering, and part of this is patient education around who do you see, which person should you see for which ailment. And obviously Pharmacy First is predominantly being cited at the moment as an initiative to try and support general practice and help people question whether they go to A&E, whether they go to an urgent care centre, to general practice or to a pharmacy. And in terms of working differently, so with general practice, we were, like you say, all face-to-face. Everybody would just either come in and make an appointment or get on the phone and make an appointment. And as we understood at the time, the infrastructure around supporting a complete movement to either remote or telephony medics was not supported. So there wasn't enough phone lines to ring out. So patients couldn't ring in, or vice versa. We couldn't ring out to patients. So there was a lot of change in terms of quick changes to infrastructure. And being a small business, you don't command the same rights with, say, people like BT or any of the other environments to be able to get something quickly when you need it. But, you know, I'm proud to say, working together with my team and collaboratively with the providers, we were able to get an additional, you know, X many amount of lines so we could dial out and talk to patients better than we could in. And, you know, in terms of talking to the team about how things work, it was a constant check-in. So, for example, I would always have a morning meeting with everybody on the phone. So they would all be in a room and we'd all talk about, and I'd have an agenda about what do we need to solve today based on the basic premise of the fact I would receive about 50 different emails overnight about the constant change in the COVID pandemic and how, you know, things like infection control and how they wanted to see telephony work, how they wanted to see, you know, so all these changes were coming down. And my biggest skill set was reading fast and skim reading everything to see what was appropriate.
Okay.
And then how to sort of determine the urgency of what was being asked, because we had, I would probably say, 20 different agencies trying to get us to change and do the way things they wanted them to do that thing. And we may not be able to support that within the practice to do that. So I'll give another example, like protecting our staff against infection. So where we were seeing patients, because we never stopped seeing patients face to face. So the ones that needed to be seen, they were always seen. but it was protecting the staff and them from any further infection, because usually the people we saw were more vulnerable than those that obviously were home. So all of the things around logistics, around getting masks, for example, at the beginning, all of these things were something that with procurement, you just took for granted. You ordered it through your website and off you go, you got them. You may not get a good price for it, but it you've got it. And at one point, I think we were spending £50 on a pack of 50 masks. And, you know, that's not sustainable. And, you know, and things move a lot slower in the NHS in terms of support that needs to be done rapidly compared to, say, where I worked in Boots and we were dealing with the swine flu, if you remember before. They can move a lot quicker, and the processes for the staff and everything else, because they had a dedicated HR team, work quickly. So for me to pick the priorities and discuss those with the partnership, and then discuss it with the wider leadership team, in engaging people within that. So people who wouldn't normally be engaged were being engaged because they needed to be part of the process of how we make decisions. And that was what I added to my skill set, is the quick fire. This is a situation. This is what we need to agree on. How are we going to agree on it? How do we engage everyone on it? Because it has to happen today. And that doing it remotely was the most challenging part. And I guess the invaluable part of my time, which was simply being able to do my rounds every day and go, and, you know, every few hours my Fitbit would buzz and I would go downstairs and go and check on everyone. How are you doing? How's things? Blah, blah, blah. Deal with little challenges. Yeah. Can't do that on the phone. You can't interrupt them while they're doing it. The phone, there isn't enough phone lines to do that. So it's all these little things that, you know, your approach to things that you'd have done in the past is completely thrown out the window. And you're having to think about that on top of how you can keep a business going and keep a service going to patients.
Wow. And I may have missed something, but there seems to be quite a few in there. So you opened up with skim reading, which I wasn't expecting you to say. And then when you when you described it, I was like, well, of course, yes, of course, that makes complete sense that you would have to be able to read that, you know, to read high volumes of information rapidly to then prioritize or to decide which needs prioritizing and which doesn't, and what actions are needed off the back of it. You've also then got some elements around procurement and commercials and infrastructure and logistics, which you might not necessarily have had to have worried about before. And then you also described that sort of that quick fire focus in terms of, right, here's a problem we need to solve today. How are we going to solve it? Who's going to do what? How is that going to work? And you described yourself earlier on as someone who is quite extroverted, quite enjoys being around people. I would also say my experience of you is one where you're quite considerate and you're quite inclusive, and you like to kind of involve people in decisions that may affect them. So with having to move at that speed and make those decisions or take those actions so quickly, how did that sit for you kind of personally in terms of, maybe I'm misattributing.
No, you don't miss it. You're not missing anything. No. I mean, I think I probably left out my personal emotional side of that, is that I felt quite isolated. So at that point, we didn't have teams, and all we had was our mobiles, and we didn't have processes in place or anything like that. And it stood in good stead, really, the 2 years I'd taken to form, you know, really good relationships with other practice managers within our primary care network, which we were setting up. So in terms of engagement, I was fully on board with being one of the leaders within that, along with a couple of others. And because we were so immersed in dealing with that prior to the pandemic, so those authentic relationships were there, to peer-to-peer support. You know, the practice managers would ring each other and discuss, what are you doing about this? Because I'm struggling to get this, and have you got any tips about that? So the collaborative working aspect wasn't a skill I didn't have, but it was one I had to approach in a greater focus on, because we wouldn't have all the answers in one practice to deal with it. because everybody was going through it as well. So I think the support that you get from connections within your own peer group, which by definition, practice manager is the loneliest position within a practice because you've got the partnership above you and you've got the practice below you, the team, which I don't ever consider people below me, but you know how I feel about that. But then you've got this, you've got no one to sort of not gripe to, but you've got no one to empty your glass to, because if you empty your glass upwards, then that's considered that in your personal position, you'd think that you're being weak by explaining that, even though you're not. And it, you know, engaging people below you of your worries, although is great and authentic, and that they're not the only ones going through that feeling, isn't conducive to helping them feel positive about the changes that we need to make and things like that. So the engagement around your peer group, it was massive. And I think fundamentally that was the one thing that made our particular primary care network come so close together, because myself and others were saying, well, what do you think? How are you approaching this? And then we were able to bring it back to partnerships and to the wider leadership and rest of the team. So I think from that approach, that would probably be the biggest learning is from that perspective.
And the that was a really similar finding that we had in, so we did some primary research in 2021 around kind of how people were feeling in the workplace at that time. And one of the things that we found certainly was that managers feel the pinch. So that pinch of I'm not sure I can share this above because there's risks I could come across at week. I'm not sure I can share this with my team because if I do, there's a risk that it might then, the team might be thinking, oh, well, if they feel that way, then, oh my goodness, it must be really bad. So, where do I go? Where do I go with those feelings? So, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the paper we published on that one. On that one as well, because within that we put in some recommendations in terms of what individuals and or kind of organizations like practices could do to help and support with that. So I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Brilliant.
So I asked you what did you add to your skill set or approaches, and I want to kind of do the contrast of that then, which is over that period of having to go from that very much in person, face to face, to being all completely remote, and to then, I guess, maybe more recently being in a more hybrid way. What did you have to let go of that you might normally have done?
Oh, well, that's one word really: control.
Okay.
Because
tell me more.
Well, because you don't have control over any situation when you're not there physically, and you have to rely on your influencing skills and your own personal resilience. And, I've had to let go of controlling every situation. You can't control everything. You can't control how people feel. You can't control the impact on the environment, i.e. the situation that was evolving outside of the practice. And so I had to stop worrying about what I couldn't do anything about, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I am not about controlling everything. I'm about mindfully understanding what I need to be involved in order to get the best out of people. But in this particular situation, there was some instances where I had to go, right, I can't help that person. I'm going to have to let somebody else do that. And there were situations where people's personal worries about the pandemic, where a staff member had a real fear of coming to work because they weren't necessarily a health risk like a number of the staff were. They were an emotional risk. So having to leave that to someone else to help them with that, and choosing who would do that in discussion with the partners was a difficult thing for me, because it had been me that would have done that and sat with them and helped them and supported them and thought of the solutions. But I had to leave that for one of the partners to do, because it was going to be their decision about how we supported them going forward, because they were a key member of staff and we didn't have the technology to allow them to work from home. Yeah, you know. So, and also, you know, when you've got people in the business that are key people, that certain processes maybe revolve around them, or certain team members need them, it becomes a situation that's emotionally charged. And I think with this particular situation, for me, it was about, I can't control that. I'm going to have to let go, because it will just eat me up inside if I can't help that person.
And what I want to ask, so I suppose if I'm allowed to, I'd like to ask a bit more specific in terms of, so what did you do to help you with that then, in terms of, so was there like a specific strategy that you used, or a specific set of techniques that you used to help you with that letting go of control?
Yes, it was actually talking to the partners that I was, you know, supporting them in the situation, and also, you know, supporting the leaders that were looking after that person as well. So for me to let go of control of dealing with the person on my own, as it were, as I'd have done, I was supporting the people supporting her, and that's what made it easier. So, you know, talking through how they were going to handle it, how their strategies and how they were feeling about the situation as well, given the fact they're also in that situation themselves, in terms of they might also be feeling anxious about it and, you know, concerned about the individual, and the people around them, and whether that would then lead to further people being anxious because that person was anxious and they were quite vocal about it. And would that then create a little bit of a ripple through everybody else to then cause a further issue? And normally you fix the small things in a business, regardless of what that issue is, you fix the small things, they don't become big ones. And so it was talking to those people that allowed me to let the control go of dealing with that particular person, and giving them the coping strategies to be able to deal with the situation, and letting them be themselves as well.
In terms of, sort of, even though you might think do it this way, as in letting them be themselves, do it in their way, in terms of how they might go about
that's
doing
correct.
That particular thing. Yeah,
that's absolutely right. Yes, basically, some people have their own style, don't they, of communicating? So rather than stymieing their method of communication, the way they communicate with people, you know, they're GPs, they know how to communicate with people, just let them get on with how they would deal with they've got the skill of dealing with patients with those emotionally charged situations, but giving them the knowledge and what they can, what they could do and what they can't do, and helping them think about what they could do differently, was, you know, part of the coaching side of things that I do on a daily basis. And that was enabling me to leave that in their control, not mine.
Yeah. Okay. So I asked, what did you add? And then I asked, what did you have to let go of? Both answers were fantastic. In terms of, what did you add? Speed reading, let go of control, which is incredibly hard to do. What was it about your leadership style, or your approach, or your philosophy of leadership, that you think served you well over that period of moving from in person to remote to hybrid?
I am, and I will say, I'm pretty resilient. I adapt pretty much to anything. Although I might be a creature of habit at home, when it comes to my work, I am very, very adaptable. I'm very resilient, and I'm much more of a positive person. I'm always seeing things from a positive perspective. Even if I can't be positive at that moment, that's my style. Yeah. So that served me really well. And so therefore, when things were, you know, hitting the fan, as they say, that resilience and adaptability and creative thinking about solutions were the things I needed, and they were there. So I was quite lucky to have built that up over the years. And I think definitely the adaptability and the resilience and being able to be creative with solutions thinking, that's really the things that helped me with remote working, for definite.
And sort of similar to my question around or my follow-up to when I said, yeah, how did you kind of do that letting go of control? So when you think about your resilience, then again, have you got particular sort of strategies or techniques or approaches that you use that you know really help you be that kind of resilient and adaptable in your approach?
I don't think I have I couldn't pin one thing down, but I've always been good in a crisis. I don't know what that innate ability is. It's something I've not really explored. I think it probably comes from conditioning in childhood. And everyone that has the battle between Gen X's and millennials and boomers would probably talk about that around, you know, how you've been brought up. It definitely conditions you to being in certain environments and being able to thrive. And I think the development in that situation of being resilient is your own personal ability to accept the things you cannot change and to look for ways that you can change yourself to help you with that situation. And I know it sounds really odd, but it doesn't seem to be something I have to consciously employ.
Okay. Yeah.
It seems to be a quality of life that has come with me throughout the situations I've been in, really. In terms of adaptability, in terms of how to adapt, that I have to consciously think about, because if it's something that doesn't align with my core values, which is, you know, truth and honesty, and I have to say something I don't really agree with, that part I have to consciously say, right, why do I need to agree to it? What is the why behind this? You know, what is the effect of me not agreeing with it and making it difficult? And then I you know, rationalize it that way, and then I come up with a strategy of how I can make it my agreement. Does that help? Does that make sense?
It does. Could you run me through
it's a solution.
There were three kind of key questions that you asked yourself there. Run me through those three key questions again.
Yeah, I guess why don't I agree with that particular situation, statement, policy, whatever it might be, and how can I make myself understand the why behind it? So why am I being asked to agree with that particular situation, event, policy, or whatever that might be?
Yeah.
And then rationalize it by going, right, well, if I don't agree with it, what is it I need to agree with that statement or policy or procedure or whatever? What will get us through all of that? And how can I rationalize the compromise in my values to enable that to happen? Because there must be a reason why it behind it. And that why at the beginning will explain why I need to engage with it. Because if I've got to explain something to someone, I've got to agree with that. So I feel like I'm rambling, but
that's really the thinking
behind it is the why, definitely.
No, and I like that. And I wanted to revisit it because I felt like they were really important points and they could have got lost in the middle.
Sure.
Because I think there's that temptation sometimes of towing the company line where somebody gives you a message, especially if it's in a period of change or adversity, you know, both of which we had in the pandemic in that example. And you're given a company line to tow. And if you don't buy it, that for me will leak out through your communication.
Yes.
And if you're a leader, then you have that leadership role to provide that clarity in that direction. So whilst you may not initially have understood or agreed with the direction that you're being asked or told or encouraged to go in, if that's the way that you've got to go because that's the decision that's been made, how you communicate that to your team, I think, is really important. So those three questions, whilst sort of deep and thoughtful questions, are also really important questions in terms of why don't I agree with that? And one of the things that I advocate for is, so if you looked at kind of basic emotion theory, there's a researcher called Paul Ekman, who I think you and I have spoken about before. And one of the things that he sort of talks about in his book Emotions Revealed is the idea that each sort of discrete emotion has its own universal trigger. So an anger would be, for example, obstruction to a goal. So in that case, there's a goal and there's an obstruction in the way. So let's say I'm being told that we have to change our operating model in a particular way. My goal might be to retain the current operating model because that's what I'm familiar with, it's what I'm comfortable with, it's what actually I think works best in my setting and in my environment. And the thing that's getting in the way is this new procedure, is this new process. So then I think, well, how can I, if I take your second question, how can I make myself understand the why then? So it's unlikely somebody's doing this to make life more difficult or to make life harder for people. So there's probably some kind of goal in there somewhere that this process or change in operating model is trying to make something better. And so is there something in that I can ascribe to or I can connect with or I can agree with? Because if there is, then it comes on to your third one about rationalizing it in terms of, well, what can I agree with? So what about this decision or what about this change can I agree with and can I engage with or can I support? Because if I can find things about it that I can engage with and support, then that will come across in the way that I then kind of communicate and share and lead whatever the change is that I'm being asked to lead. So I think those three questions are really important.
Yeah, and also it's the story you tell as a result of those three questions that you've thought through. So how you tell that story. But the other thing for me, Phil, as well, like you were talking about advocating for people to be able to have that voice to say what they're not comfortable with or comfortable with. I mean, during the pandemic and the remote situations I was having, they're the people on the ground. So if there was something that I was suggesting as part of the things that I'd had to skim read and put in place or collaborate with people and try and implement, at the end of the day, they're the people at the end of it, the sharp end of it. And they're the people that need to be engaged in it. And if you're not able to tell that story of the why and help them understand why people are asking them to do what they're being asked to do, whether or not it agrees with their own core values, the solution to it can be how they want to implement it. They need to be a part of it. And again, telling that story, once you've got it through in your mind and you're absolutely 100% on board with that, the why behind it, and you know you're going to be advocating for that particular situation, then that story you tell to them and getting them engaged in it, for them then to say, don't agree with that, absolutely rubbish, you don't know what you're talking about. And then saying, right, okay, so what is the solution then? So how are we going to approach this? And that actually does then engage people a lot quicker because they've heard your story, they've heard, and it's not going to work in their mind, but getting them to actually come back to you and go, well, if it's not going to work this way, it might work that way. And you still end up with delivering what you need to deliver, but you've gone through that cyclic journey about how they then thought through those three questions in their own mind, but they don't realize they're doing it.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, I like that a lot. Thank you. So having had the experiences that you've had then, both kind of, again, I suppose I keep coming back to, you know, prior to, during, and then after, after the pandemic. So for our listeners who might have tuned into this episode because, you know, we're talking about remote and hybrid leadership and leading in that remote and hybrid way, what advice might you give to our listeners to help them be effective or be successful or to find their way with remote or hybrid leadership?
So I reflected on this quite considerably because I'm now more hybrid working as opposed to completely remote. So I think the biggest learning is communication. You know, everything boils down to how you communicate, and you've got to not be afraid of not, as I call it, eyeballing your team or your leaders, because if you can't see them physically, you do miss the red flags that you get when someone's communicating with you and you see them go, you know, eyebrow raised or, you know, face falls or something like that. You can't see that when you're talking on a phone. You might see it if you're on Teams, but again, it's always lost in translation if you're in a meeting with many people. The communication side of things is really, really part of it. And so you've got to be super clear on your needs to your leaders as much as you are to those that you lead. And being out of sight does not mean that you're out of mind. So if your team know you're there and they trust you, that you'll be there on the phone, on Teams, instant messages, however you've, you know, discussed when you're going to be available to them, how you're going to be available to them, when you're not available and why, because when you're invisible, people think that because you're not there, you're not doing anything, which is a clear thing that behavior you get from a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You know, if you tell them what you're doing, as well as telling them when you're available to them and how you're available to them, then it becomes easier. It really does. And I found that sitting with a group of people on a phone or around around one phone as how we started and how we ended up on Teams or how we still end up on instant messages or phone calls and whatnot, it's all about managing expectations and being really clear on your communication. And I think that is the biggest thing that you can bring to hybrid or remote working is adapting your communication style, I would probably say your over communication style. So to check in with people about how they want to be communicated with while you're not there. Because fundamentally, if you're not there, they it's not a comfort blanket because you're not the only person in the place that can support people. But if they know you're there and they can always call you, or they know what you're doing and why you're not there, then they're much more engaged and they don't think you're sitting with your feet up having a coffee or having a chat on the phone to another manager and having a gossip. They know that you're doing this and you're doing that and when they can expect to have you back and when they want to talk to you. And every day when I'm in the practice, my Fitbit buzzes every 50 minutes. I haven't done enough steps. So down I go. How's everyone? Everyone okay? I might even make a coffee now and again for people, you know, that every 50 minutes or at least every lunchtime, dropping your head in to work to the nurses or whoever's in the tea room, that physical contact is easy. But when you're remote or hybrid, it becomes a quick instant message. How is everybody? What do you need? What are you struggling with today? Do you want to talk about anything? Those things before you then give instruction, because there's no point in giving people, you know, downloading your information and expecting them to receive it when they need to download theirs first about why you've not been here. This is what I've been going through. And then you can fill that glass back up with what you need them to do and how they can tackle things. So I think that learning with hybrid and remote is literally about communication. It's literally about setting expectations for your team and what they want from you, what you're doing when you're not there, because that also is a factor of any human behavior. You think you're not doing anything if you're not there or not visible. And don't just deliver what you want them to do. Don't just, the first communication with them should never be, oh, can you make sure you do X, X, Y, Z, whatever today. It's like, how are you? What are you up to? What's been your challenge today? What can I help you with? And I've learned over the years to have a pad by my phone and I'm writing down stuff I'm thinking of while they're talking to me. Although I'm present and I am talking to them, I'm also receiving information of things that they need to do. So I have a pad by my phone or my computer, and I'm constantly writing down stuff I need to pick up with them after they've emptied their glass, because otherwise you just interrupt them and they lose their train. They think, what's the point in trying to communicate with you? So I think that's also another learning, as I'm talking to you and thinking about it, is the method of contact when you have it remotely, is don't just download your rubbish. Give them a chance to download their rubbish to you, empty their glass, and then you can fill it up with the stuff you need, and you're more likely to get the engagement and that they've been heard, is their feeling. Yeah, I think that's about it really.
Fab. Wonderful. Thank you. So I think then there were, I'm going to say three, because I genuinely think there was three, but I also like three. So
three's a good number.
Three is a good number. So it's a magic number, according to De La Soul.
It is.
So I think there's something, I'm going to go in reverse order. So there's something about the method of engagement, so how you're engaging with your team in that remote and hybrid way, and the example that you were giving there about, you know, having that pen and paper, for example, to hand, so that if there are thoughts that go off in your own head, you can write them down so that those thoughts are safe, and so you can retain your attention and your focus on the other, you know, on the person that you're engaging with, or the team that you're engaging with at that particular time. Secondly, it's about setting expectations, being clear about what those expectations are in terms of method or means or time or quantity of communication, in terms of how you're going to, you know, how often are you going to connect, where, how are you connecting, you know, if you're stuck, what do you need, if I'm not around, who do you go to, if you need to escalate something rapidly, how do we do that? You know, so those expectations being really clear, so that there's no ambiguity for people. Because if you're there, someone could look at you and wave, you know, dramatically to signal that you need their attention. Whereas if they can't see you, they don't know if you're busy or not or what. So having those expectations is really clear. And then the third thing that you were describing was around engaging the person as an individual before you engage them in the work or the content or the task or the activity that needs to be discussed or explored or kind of cascaded.
Absolutely succinct, and better than I could have explained it. Yes.
No. I couldn't have done it if it wasn't for you. So
bless you.
If your thinking wasn't there, I wouldn't have been able to summarize it in that way.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So there's one final question that I'll let you know what the question is now, so it just gives you a little bit of time to think about it, because I hadn't shared with you beforehand that I was going to ask this question.
Okay.
And this is kind of the way that we start to move in towards the end of the podcast as well. So the question I want to ask is, kind of looking back on it now, what surprised you? So what surprised you about your leadership over that period of time? But before we hear your thinking on that, just wanted to share something with the listeners around what emotion at work are about and what we do, because you might think, well, this is the emotion at work podcast and that's great, but what do emotion at work actually do? So we're about restoring and revitalizing work environments where people feel safe, they feel confident, and they feel optimistic about what's to come. And we do that by applying a combination of analysis, advice, and application that enables individuals or teams or companies as a whole to safely and successfully engage with all of their emotions. And we do that through deploying a suite of methods and tools that can equip people. It can also educate them and ultimately enrich kind of their lives as individuals, as teams, or as an organization as a whole. So if you're interested in work environments where people feel safe, where they feel confident and they feel optimistic about the future, then we are the people to help you with that. So Emma, back to you. In terms of when you think about your leadership over that kind of period, remote hybrid leadership, what surprised you?
So I know I talked about resilience being one of my qualities that I don't know where I get it from. Mm. I'm still surprised by the fact I can cope with being on my own completely, just with a dog during, you know, a year and a bit of remote leadership and not having the contact with people I normally thrive with. So I did that. So that's for me is a surprise that, because everybody talks about the pandemic and how it changed them. The pandemic changed me only from the perspective of an awareness that pretty much cope with anything. And that was that was a thing for me, because, you know, my routine changed, the way I work changed, everything changed, and I had no one to share that with except by the communications that with my team or with my friends, and it was all remote. So, you know, you don't have anyone to share that day-to-day stuff with when you're at home with people or at work with people. So learning that you can pretty much cope with anything at that point is quite a good quality and feeling to have.
That sounds like a wonderful feeling to have.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
Don't wish that on anyone in terms of having to do that, but, you know, in terms of knowing it for yourself, it's good because absolutely. It means that whatever might come in the future, you've got that to stand you in good stead.
Yeah, definitely.
Although, okay. You know, my team might laugh because pretty much all they did was talk about gossipy TV shows where we actually got a chance to talk about nothing. So I had my chance to pick up on those ones as well.
That's good. Nothing wrong with gossipy TV shows. Imagine absolutely. If the traitors had been released over COVID times.
Oh my goodness.
All right. So if others were interested in finding out more about kind of leadership in remote and hybrid ways, are there any resources, so maybe authors or videos or talks or books or things that you might recommend for people to say, you know what, this might, if you're having to lead in a remote and hybrid way and you haven't done that before or you want to develop that, then these are some of the things that I would advocate for you to look at.
So I think from a behavioural point of view, as I mentioned to you earlier, I'm studying an AMBA at the moment and currently going for a Leading Global Teams and Organizations module, and there's quite a lot of reading around that. But I quite like the idea of understanding yourself better. And I think in order to work remotely or work with a hybrid methodology, you've really got to understand yourself first, and you've got to know what your strengths are. You've got to know, you know, what your qualities are. And there's a number of things you can look at. So there's the Myers-Briggs ones, which I think I access when I do coaching for people on the 16personalities.com. Mm-hmm. And to know yourself on that sort of ENFP is who I am. They don't define you, but they give you an understanding about the why behind you. And currently at the moment, I've just done something on the big five within this MBA, which again is another behavioural test you can do to sort of understand other types of parts of your essence. And also I think I do like listening to TED Talks. So as I alluded to earlier, you know, starting a movement with the lone nut and the followers. I think there was a one on TED, I think it was Derek Sivers, he did one on how to start a movement, and it always makes me giggle when I watch that video, and that just makes you laugh. And from that perspective, you think, yes, it might be a serious piece of information, but that 2 minutes of seeing somebody dance like an idiot and the why people get up and dance after them is, you know, quite inspiring. And again, things about the why behind things is really important to me as well. And I watched Simon Sinek talk about that on a TED talk about how great leaders inspire action by helping people engage through the why. And I think that's another good thing to look at it. So I've changed the way I perhaps look at recruitment as well now. So when I get my team together and they do the Myers-Briggs, or they might do Clifton's Strengths Finders through Gallup, or they might do any of these, it's like, who do we have missing from our tribe that can contribute and make us whole? And I kind of look at that in another way as well, through using those different books and talks and videos and see, right, how can you create the perfect team where you've got different behaviors and different qualities and different values and bring them together. So that's probably where I would get people to have a look at all these different things.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll put links to all of those things in the show notes as well. So all that leads me to ask then, is there something else then, Emma? Something else that you're thinking, feeling, or would like to say before we close?
Do you know, I'm very passionate about general practice, and I never thought I would be, because I thought, oh, I'm going back into practice, being a practice manager, which, you know, when you move to a regional manager role and you're moving about and you're, you know, doing different leadership styles and whatnot, and then you're back in a team of people that you see day in, day out. I love it. These people are great. They go through a heck of a lot. You know, and coming from retailing optical leadership to general practice, the one thing that makes me sad every day is how people treat one another. So, you know, social media and telephone, it's all faceless. And again, when we talked earlier about social cues not being there when someone doesn't see that person, it's quite still very prevalent in general practice. And I think, you know, the fact that they're in crisis now with the lack of funding, and they genuinely are the coffee filter of the NHS and only receive 7% of the funding, right now you're probably likely to start losing practices and things. And it's not the people resilience, and it's not the leaders within those practices. It's just simply what's going on now. And that is where I'm thinking at the moment. What do we need to do to make sure we still got primary care for all of the patients in Britain, because the NHS is amazing. And, you know, for people to be so negative about it on social media or even the media itself, we need to create a movement. So I'm starting that. So Phil, follow me. you know, I really want people to think that, you know, the people in the businesses don't have this attitude of, I'm not giving you an appointment. I don't care that you don't have it. They all care about it. Everybody from the partners down, everyone cares about the patients, but there just simply isn't the funding and space to deliver the service that they would love to do, you know. And they're so amazing, the people I work with. And thank you, Phil, for inviting me to talk to you about everything that's gone on in the last few years. And it's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on. The pleasure has absolutely been all mine. All right, then. Thank you so much, Emma, for coming on. Thank you for sharing your experiences, your insights and your thoughts on emotional work in remote and hybrid leadership. And to you, fair listener, thank you for your time, and we'll see you in the next episode.
You've been listening to the Emotion at Work podcast, and if you got this far, you must be interested in the role that emotions have in the workplace, either within individuals, between people in teams, or in organisations as a whole. So head over to the Emotion at Work Hub, which you can find at community.emotionatwork.co.uk. Thanks for listening.